This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 26, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. The House and Senate passed the war supplemental bill, but Republicans and anti-war groups are denouncing the measure. A federal lawsuit is filed against the NYPD for violating the civil rights of three black men on Cop Watch patrol. And we'll hear from Ecuador, where plans for rewriting the Constitution have fueled a political crisis. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Somalia's interim prime minister has declared victory in the battle for control over the capital city, Mogadishu. Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi claimed that the city would be completely secured by tomorrow, but political observers and diplomats are not so sure. Today's announcement comes after 9 days of heavy fighting killed hundreds of civilians and forced residents to abandon entire sections of the city. The United Nations estimates that 340,000 people have fled Mogadishu since early February. The death toll in Baghdad continued to rise today with a car bombing in a southern neighborhood and a military raid on Sadr City. Heba Dawood reports.
For the last 3 months, Iraqi security forces and American troops have arrested hundreds of followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, accusing them of forming anti-Sunni death squads. Today, a more aggressive offensive took place in Sadr City. American forces in helicopters and military vehicles raided the huge Shiite neighborhood and killed three members of the Sadrists, later calling them terrorists. Hamdallah Rikabi is a spokesman for the Sadr movement in Baghdad.
Sadr City is open only to Sadrists, and all the residents are followers of the movement. It doesn't have any terrorists. Iraqis have never heard of any instance in which suicide bombers turn out to be from the movement.
Meanwhile, in southern Baghdad, a car bomb killed 6 people and wounded 15 others. In a separate incident, gunmen today killed the wife and daughter of Hashim Majid, the brother of Chemical Ali and cousin of Saddam Hussein. For FSRN, I'm Hiba Dawood.
An investigative report published this week in one of Canada's top newspapers has accused Canada's conservative government of complicity in the torture of Afghan prisoners and has created a national controversy. Stephen Christoph reports from Montreal.
Canadian support for the mission in Afghanistan has wavered as the war drags on, and an investigative report published this week by the Globe and Mail has sparked intense debate. The report alleges that Afghans detained by Canadian soldiers and transferred to Afghan jails have been beaten, whipped, starved, frozen, and choked during interrogation. Graham Smith is a Globe and Mail reporter in Kandahar who broke the story.
The people told me that they were often beaten with electrical cables. That was the most common complaint. Others said that they were electrocuted, and one man gave me a particularly graphic description of being electrocuted with a hand crank generator and flopping around on the floor like a fish.
Opposition political parties in Canada are calling for the resignation of the defense minister. An internal Canadian government report made public yesterday outlines that Canadian military and governmental authorities have been aware of the torture committed by subordinate Afghan authorities prior to the publication of the Globe and Mail report. This is Stefan Christoph reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
The European Union's Parliament unanimously passed a resolution today calling for the unconditional release of BBC reporter Alan Johnston, who was abducted by gunmen in Gaza 6 weeks ago. FSRN's Rami Almagheri has more.
The EU's Parliament's resolution urges the Palestinian Authority to intensify efforts to secure the unconditional and swift release of the BBC reporter. The resolution also calls on the Palestinian Authority to thoroughly investigate attacks on journalists and civilians in Gaza and bring those involved to justice. Palestinian, Israeli and international journalists demonstrated yesterday on both sides of the Gaza-Israel borderline in northern Gaza against the captivity of Johnston, calling on the Palestinian Authority to secure his release. John Floto is the BBC's senior news producer in the Middle East.
I mean, obviously we welcome any piece of information, any news from any quarter that says Alan is alive and well. We have still not received direct confirmation of Alan's status.
15 foreign journalists have been abducted and released unharmed in Gaza over the past 3 years. Johnston has endured the longest captivity of any foreign journalist or aid worker. This is Rami Almighari reporting from Gaza.
New Hampshire's legislature has approved a measure to recognize same-sex civil unions in the state. Governor John Lynch earlier announced that he would sign it into law. New Hampshire will become the fourth state to recognize civil unions. Massachusetts continues to be the only state where gay marriage is legal. And finally, today marks the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica. On this day in 1937, during the height of the Spanish Civil War, German Nazis and Italian fascists sent planes to the town of Guernica in Spanish Basque Country. The bombing of Guernica is widely regarded as the first of a series of terror bombings of civilian areas during the Spanish Civil War and World War II. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The war supplemental is headed to the president's desk now that both the House and the Senate received enough votes to pass it. But Republicans and anti-war groups are denouncing the measure. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
For the second time, lawmakers passed a war spending bill with a timeline for withdrawal. It passed the House of Representatives last night 218 to 208, picking up one Democratic vote, Diane Watson of California. With the Senate final passage of 51 to 46, the Democrats didn't gain or lose any votes. Presidential candidate John McCain did not vote. He was out campaigning. The White House once again said the bill is unacceptable. The $124 billion spending bill provides $95 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, $7 billion for Katrina recovery, and money for veterans' health. It includes a U.S. withdrawal date to begin from Iraq no later than October of this year, and has a non-binding goal to remove all U.S. combat forces 6 months later. The debate was highly partisan, with Democrats bashing the president and his choices as commander-in-chief. Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia.
He will be holding funding for the troops hostage to his stubborn insistence on going into Iraq and the resulting disaster caused by his, the president's, war policies.
Pleased they could still maintain a slim majority, Democrats urged the president to sign the bill. Senator Harry Reid says it's now in their hands.
There is not a word from the White House about changing direction in that war. Maybe if he does veto this bill, maybe he will come to the conclusion that it's time to change direction of this war, and he will sit and talk to us.
Two Republicans in the House and two in the Senate supported the bill, but most Republicans stood by the president in their opposition. They oppose several billions of dollars added to the bills not related to the wars and not deemed an emergency. But the withdrawal timeline is the main reason for opposition, calling it a surrender document. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
And the solution to getting the money to the troops is clear. Take out the surrender date, take out the pork, and send the money for the troops down to the president for signature.
Some Republicans did acknowledge that the situation in Iraq is not all good. Assistant Minority Leader Trent Lott.
But here we are trying to set ourselves up as the final judges. General Petraeus was here yesterday telling us what's going on. He was honest. He didn't say it's perfect.
Lott referred to the Capitol Hill briefing by the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus. While the Senate was passing the war spending bill, protesters filled the atrium and the halls of one of the Senate office buildings. They read letters from U.S. soldiers and their families, they hung banners from the interior balconies that read, "Bring the troops home," and they wandered through the lobby with tape over their mouth, with the number of American deaths in Iraq written on the tape, 3,334.
We will not wait for the Democratic leadership until they deem to bring the troops back. We, the people, elected these people to bring the troops home, to bring them home now.
The president is expected to receive and veto the bill by Monday. Then the bill writing process will start from the beginning, taking at least several weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate Armed Services Committee heard testimony today in favor and against rolling back the Military Commissions Act and restoring habeas corpus for all detainees held by the Department of Defense as unlawful enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Nan McCurdy has more from the Capitol.
The rollback of the Military Commissions Act would restore habeas corpus for any individual held in U.S. custody. It would prohibit the use of evidence in court gained through torture and would restore Geneva Convention protections. Linda Gustitis from the National Religious Coalition Against Torture was one of 50 protesters at today's hearing.
We're here to show the Armed Services Committee, the Senate Armed Services Committee, that we care deeply about torture and detention, the torture and detention practices of this administration. With the Military Commissions Act, the government is allowed to use coerced testimony against the detainees, and coerced testimony could include testimony received as a result of torture.
Senator Carl Levin, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, supports the rollback of the Military Commissions Act because of the following provisions.
Narrow the accepted definitions of cruel and inhuman treatment. 2, authorize the administration to unilaterally redefine its obligations under the Geneva Conventions. 3, allow the use of hearsay and coerced testimony in criminal trials of detainees. 4, insulate senior administration officials from accountability for detainee abuses. 5, bar detainees from ever bringing any legal action challenging any aspect of their detention. 6, prohibit the courts from providing legal relief for detainees who are found to be improperly held.
Senator Levin says there are many reasons to prohibit the abuse of detainees and coerce testimony.
It's morally wrong. It produces unreliable information. It violates domestic and international law. It undermines the support we need in the world community to win the war against terrorism. And it jeopardizes our own troops if they are captured.
Mark P. Denbo, professor of law at Seton Hall Law School, has reviewed the publicly available records of the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, the tribunals that determine a combatant status at Guantanamo. He found that only 5% of Guantanamo detainees were captured by U.S. forces on the battlefield. 86% were apprehended either by Pakistan or the Northern Alliance and turned over to the United States at a time when the U.S. was offering large bounties for suspected terrorists. He says the government made statements that were totally false about the Guantanamo detainees. Mark Denbo.
One of those statements was the detainees there are the worst of the worst.
He described when a law student showed him the entire tribunal against one detainee.
It said, detainee is associated with the Taliban. He indicates he was conscripted into the Taliban. He was engaged in hostilities against the U.S. or its coalition partners. 1, he was a cook's assistant for the Taliban forces. 2, he fled from Nareem to Kabul during the Northern Alliance attack and surrendered to the Northern Alliance. That's the entire charge upon which he was being held.
Denbo says it's frightening to look at the records and the personal histories of those imprisoned at Guantanamo. According to government records, 55% of detainees are not even accused of committing a hostile act. Mr. Denbo added that the assistant cook was found to be an enemy combatant, and he remains at Guantanamo to this day, after 5 years with no impartial review. For FSRN, I'm Nan McCurdy.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency announced this morning that it will continue to fund housing assistance for tens of thousands of families displaced in the Gulf Coast for an additional 18 months. The deadline for housing assistance was set to expire on the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina this summer. FSRN's Christian Roseland is in New Orleans with more.
Today's extension of the rental assistance deadline was a joint effort of the Federal Coordinator for Gulf Coast Rebuilding, FEMA, and the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. Donald Powell, the Federal Coordinator for Gulf Coast Rebuilding, says the Bush administration was moved by the need to provide security in the lives of those still affected by the disasters following Hurricane Katrina.
I think it was driven to make sure that the people that are in this temporary housing, their needs, and bringing certainty into their lives was how do we best do that, at the same time, obviously, being good stewards of the taxpayers' money.
An estimated 120,000 displaced persons are still receiving help paying rents that in many cases have doubled since the storm. FEMA tops the list of federal agencies that locals cite in the government's failed responses to the hurricane and levee failures. Even though FEMA's latest step is good news for many in the Gulf Coast, some are not optimistic about the agency's role.
I think that this announcement is a face-saving maneuver for the administration.
Soleil Rodrigue is a housing rights activist and caseworker with the Common Ground Collective and Survivors Village. Rodriguez says she doesn't believe that FEMA's latest move changes the basic trend of the agency to cut more and more people from disaster assistance roles.
It's great PR for them, and it is good news that at least there's not a massive deadline approaching, but I think that most of us expect that this will just be a continuation of a slow, steady attrition, slow, steady loss of services and resources and assistance that has been going on since the programs began, really.
Families currently on the rental assistance program will start to pay a portion of the costs starting March 1st, 2008. For FSRN, this is Christian Roseland.
Six Ecuadorian opposition congressional lawmakers have fled to Colombia, apparently seeking asylum for what they say is political prosecution. 50 lawmakers were reinstated to their posts in Congress by the Constitutional Tribunal this week, but a state prosecutor has now ordered the arrest of 24 of those lawmakers for treason and threatening the nation's security. The arrest orders came after the lawmakers attempted to bar a vote for a constitutional assembly, prompting some of the lawmakers to flee to Colombia and set off mass demonstrations against their actions outside Congress. The government says it has nothing to do with the arrest warrants and has petitioned the prosecutor to drop the charges. Nevertheless, the six lawmakers say they fear returning to Ecuador. They're led by Alvaro Noboa, who lost his bid for president to Rafael Correa last year. Meanwhile, a new poll shows that after 100 days in office, President Correa's approval rating stands at 76%, and that 73% of Ecuadorians believe the president is correct in his stance to move forward with rewriting the Constitution. Diego Falconi is the advisor to Ecuador's interior minister. He says that despite demonstrations against the lawmakers trying to bar the process, many Ecuadorians are hopeful about a new constitution.
There has been groups of citizens, in Quito especially, which have demonstrated in front of Congress, trying to express the rejection that the Ecuadorian people feel for the members of Congress. But in Quito right now, the capital, we can feel an environment of tranquility and peace. And you can see the public opinion is completely in favor of the government and about continuing this process of going towards the Constitutional Assembly.
Falconi says that the current constitution empowers the country's elite and explains why the president is having such a difficult time carrying out his mandate.
Our constitution right now, which was approved in 1998, makes the government like an instrument of private interests. It is very clear how, with some measures in the Constitution, they have enabled private companies, both national and multinational, they have been able to use the government directly for their interests. Concessions to all natural resources have been completely very easy process for any company who desires to exploit those resources. Privatization of water and other resources have been an ongoing process that have caused terrible problems in the country.
Falconi describes how the new constitution seeks more representation from the people.
Basically, that we want to ask the people of Ecuador and have the people of Ecuador decide what are the new rules to live in this country. How do we want to use our resources? How do we want our democracy to work? How do we want the citizens and the people to be able to control government?
Diego Falconi is the advisor to Ecuador's interior minister. A campaign in London for immigrants' rights is gaining momentum. Today, the British Parliament will begin to discuss proposals to regularize up to 500,000 undocumented immigrants, granting them work permits and access to benefits. Manuel Rueda is in London, where he spoke with migrants who might benefit from the plan.
Today is the day which you've got to go report. You're not sure whether you're going to come out there all right or not. I just pray a lot and ask for God to guide me, to let me not stay in there or let them detain me to send me home, because that will be the end of my life.
John is a political refugee. Every month, he checks in with local authorities at an immigration reporting center near London Bridge.
I normally carry this bag here, because I've got my toothbrush, my toothpaste, my photos, things that are close to me that I need at all times.
John came to the UK in the year 2000, seeking refuge from political persecution in Zimbabwe. He applied for political asylum, but his claim was denied. He now has a temporary right to stay in the country, but he's not allowed to work or to claim benefits. John is one of thousands of people who would benefit from a new immigration plan that was introduced to Britain's Parliament today. This scheme is known as the Regularization of Illegal Immigrants. It would grant a temporary work permit to those who have been here for over 4 years, and it would allow them to apply for citizenship 2 years later, as long as they provide good references and a clean criminal record. But opponents of this move feel that it may encourage undocumented immigration into the country. They say that providing working papers to hundreds of thousands of migrant workers would encourage more people to enter the country illegally. Austin Ivory coordinates Strangers into Citizens, the campaign group that is seeking the backing of Parliament. He challenges this claim.
There's no evidence of that. The US had its green card scheme back in 1986. A number of European countries have had regularization schemes. 4.5 million people since 1981 have been regularized. There has been no noticeable increase as a direct result of regularization in illegal immigration.
The campaign intensifies as government officials voice their concerns about growing immigration rates. Just last week, Immigration Minister Liam Byrne told national newspapers that mass migration into Britain has left the country deeply unsettled. He also revealed plans to change Britain's immigration system so that only those who have the skills required by the economy can come to live in the UK. Government ministers have the final say in immigration policy, but pressure from Parliament and other sectors may persuade them to grant an amnesty to undocumented immigrants. This is Manuel Rueda, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
According to the International Red Cross, HIV/AIDS cases are increasing by 30% in China each year. It's unclear whether this figure is the result of better data collection methods or a greater willingness to admit to being positive. But what is certain is that while certain high-risk groups are gradually gaining more support from Chinese society, the male gay community still faces high levels of discrimination. FSRN's Elise Potaka has more from Beijing.
The latest official figures put the number of people living with HIV/AIDS in China at around 650,000. Although intravenous drug use is thought to be the largest single means of HIV transmission, new research shows that patients infected through sex are the largest growing group. The government is implementing education programs to try and reduce transmission and discrimination. But at a seminar in Beijing, Professor Jing Jun of Tsinghua University's AIDS Policy Centre told listeners that one high-risk group still faces an uphill battle.
I think Chinese people are ready to stop discriminating against sex workers. I think to some extent, Chinese will accept the drug users as well, because more and more literature are showing that 75% of drug users are youngsters. And we have a problem with our school system. We have a problem with our examination system. We have a problem with the way we treat our next generation. But the real question to ask is that, are we going to stop discriminating against gay people? And that's a really fundamental question.
Kaka, not his real name, is a member of Rainbow, a support group for gay men in the east coast province of Shandong.
We can't tell our classmates or our colleagues. If we open up to them, maybe they'll discriminate against us. They just wouldn't understand at all.
The group aims to promote safe sex and to provide information about HIV/AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. But they also discuss ways to reduce stigma and discrimination against their community.
The most important issues are health and acceptance. For us, discrimination can be as bad as the sickness itself. We want to get rid of discrimination and create a healthy community.
Official figures suggest that 7.3% of HIV-infected individuals in China are men who have sex with men, or MSM. At the start of last year, the government formally listed gay men as a high-risk group.
but it was only this week that the government announced its first intervention program for gay men. In the past, this work has been left up to NGOs and community organisations. But running a community group aimed at reducing the number of infections in the gay community is not easy. Xuan Xuan, another member of Rainbow, says that sometimes just admitting to being gay can lead to a violent response from some in the broader community.
They will threaten us, attack us. If we tell them we're MSM, that's a typical response.
Another problem members of Rainbow face is that the organisation is not officially registered as a non-government organisation or NGO. In China, this is a complicated process, and many groups have to work independently or under the wing of a larger organization. Kaka and Xuan Xuan both say that this creates a problem with funding. They say it's hard to gain the trust of funding bodies if you're not officially registered. The government has now said that they will make it easier for organisations which promote AIDS intervention measures and help high-risk groups. But it's unclear what exactly this means for groups like Rainbow. From Beijing, this is Elise Portaka for Free Speech Radio News. A federal lawsuit was filed today in New York's South District Court, claiming the NYPD violated the civil rights of three black men when they were on Cop Watch patrol for the Malcolm X grassroots movement. Cop Watch is a group that seeks to expose, document, and deter instances of police misconduct and abuse in communities of color. According to data released by the NYPD this year, stop and frisks have increased by more than 500% since 2002, and that more than half of those stopped were black. Whites made up only 11.1% of the stops, this in a city where 25% of the population is black and 44% is white. From New York, Rebecca Miles files this report.
An excerpt from the following video shows a confrontation between New York police officer Thomas Stevens and Asaw Floyd in February 2005 after Floyd and his friends had come to witness arrests by NYPD and filmed the activity as part of their regular cop watch patrol.
Move. I'm asking you to back up right now.
And we are backing up. Why
right.
are you
I'm asking you to back up. All right?
I'm asking you to identify
I'm asking
yourself.
You to back up.
I'm asking you to identify yourself. You can put
here.
Your hands on
okay.
me.
Okay.
Live over here.
You're refusing to move?
No, we're
your hands behind your back.
Floyd was knocked to the ground, the video camera was smashed, and the three men were arrested, held for 24 hours in jail, and charged with assault, resisting arrest, and obstructing government administration. The charges against the three were eventually dismissed in court in July 2006. Now the plaintiffs Lumumba Bandele, Debril Tour and Dasaw Floyd seek compensatory and punitive damages and further ask that the city declares that individuals and groups have the right to observe and videotape the activities of the NYPD. The lawsuit claims the City of New York and employees of the NYPD violated the Civil Rights Act of 1871 and 1983 and rights secured by the 1st, 4th, 5th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. Andrea Costello is one of the Center for Constitutional Rights attorneys representing the three men.
The order was unlawful in the first place because they had a First Amendment right to be there and observing the police activity, and they were a reasonable distance away. So even though the order was unlawful, they still complied with it. So there was no reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop, detain, and arrest them in the first place.
The lawsuit was filed in court this afternoon, and calls seeking comment from NYPD were not returned before broadcast. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles, reporting from New York.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from Pacifica Station, KPFK, in Los Angeles. This is Aura Bogado.